Mark chapter 5, and beginning to read at verse 21. In the earlier part of this chapter, the Lord had crossed the Sea of Galilee and gone to the land of Gadara. And you remember there how the man met him out of the tombs, a demon-possessed man, and the Lord had healed him. And then he had sent him back to be his witness to the people who had known him in his unconverted days. And we take up the story in verse 21. And when Jesus was passed over again by boat onto the other side, many people gathered unto him, and he was nigh unto the sea. And behold, there cometh one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name. And when he saw him, he fell at his feet, and besought him greatly, saying, My little daughter lieth at the point of death. I pray thee, come and lay thy hands on her, that she may be healed, and she shall live. And Jesus went with him, and many people followed him and crowded him. And a certain woman who had an issue of blood 12 years, and had suffered many things of many physicians, and had spent all that she had, and was no better, but rather grew worse, when she heard of Jesus, came in the crowd behind him and touched his garment. For she said, If I may touch but his clothes, I shall be made whole. And straightway the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of that plague. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned about in the crowd and said, Who touched my clothes? And his disciples said unto him, Thou seest the multitude crowding thee, and sayest thou, Who touched me? And he looked round about to see her that had done this thing. But the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what was done in her, came and fell down before him, and told him all the truth. And he said unto her, Daughter, thy faith hath made thee well. Go in peace, and be well of thy plague. While he yet spoke, there came from the ruler of the synagogue's house certain who said, Thy daughter is dead. Why troublest thou the master any further? Soon as Jesus heard that word that was spoken, he saith unto the ruler of the synagogue, Be not afraid, only believe. And he permitted no man to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. And he cometh to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and seeth the multitude and those that wept and wailed greatly. And when he was come in, he saith unto them, Why make ye this ado and weep? The child is not dead, but sleepeth. And they laughed him to scorn. And when he had put them all out, he taketh the father and the mother of the child, and those who were with him, and entered in where the child was lying. And he took the child by the hand and said unto her, Talitha kumai, which is being interpreted, Little girl, I say unto thee, arise. And straightway the child arose and walked, for she was of the age of 12 years. And they were astonished with a great astonishment. And he charged them strictly that no man should know it, and commanded that something should be given her to eat. And we'll end there at verse 43. We have a saying in this part of the world that when a person's in a difficult situation, they're between a rock and a hard place. And I think we all know what that means. That's where Jairus was on this day of which we read in Mark 5, for he had a terrible decision to make, and it was this. Should he stay at the bedside of his beloved dying daughter, hold her hand and minister to her as best he could until the end, or should he leave her, knowing that he might never see her again, and go out and look for Jesus of Nazareth? Would his daughter, in her moments of consciousness, understand his absence if he went? Or would she feel he had deserted her at the time she needed him most? He might not find this healer from Nazareth. It might be a waste of time. That was the choice. He was on the horns of a dilemma, but nothing tried, nothing gained. He decided it was all or nothing, took one last long lingering look, and left the room. Can you see him as he goes down the street, asking this one and that one, "Have you seen Jesus of Nazareth? Do you know where he is? Was he here today?" Then it may be that he met someone who said, "Yes, I saw him heading out in a boat with his followers, looking as if they were going across the lake towards Gadara." Jairus' heart must have dropped into his boots when he heard that. But at least it was a lead of sorts. And so he heads off down towards the quayside. It seems from the reading in Mark 5 that both Jairus and the Lord Jesus arrived on the shore about the same time. If that's the case, then I'm sure it was by divine appointment. Have you ever noticed, as you read through Scripture, that the Lord was always on time for his appointments? You remember when he sat on Sychar's well? He was there waiting for the woman when she arrived. And you know it's a good principle in life. When I was in business, I always tried to be there early. If you arrive late, the first thing you have to do is apologize, and that puts you on the wrong foot right from the start, and particularly if there are negotiations. So it's a good principle to follow the Lord in this respect. The passage tells us that the Lord was nigh unto the sea when Jairus spoke to him. And I take it that he was just out of the boat. And when Jairus made his request, the Lord promptly agreed to go with him. Now it looked like Jairus was getting somewhere at last. But the question was, would he be in time? However, just when it seemed that things were starting to move in Jairus' direction, he discovered a different problem. There was a crowd around them. People were thronging him. The crowd was getting in the way. Progress was slow. That was bad enough, but then this woman came out of nowhere and touched his clothing. Now, you men know if there's one thing women are good at, it's keeping you back, especially when you're in a hurry. And this one was an expert. In less time than it takes to tell it, she brought the whole procession to a halt. And it was just then that things, it seemed, came to a full stop for Jairus in more ways than one. Because it was at that point he got the message he dreaded. "Thy daughter is dead." At that moment, I'm sure he could have echoed the words of Jacob. "All these things are against me." It must have seemed that circumstances had conspired to keep the Lord from getting to his daughter in time. The visit to Gadara, the crowd, then this woman. It seemed Murphy's Law, or the Jewish equivalent, had been in operation the whole time, and everything that could go wrong had gone wrong. It seemed he had made the wrong choice. It seemed he should have stayed at his daughter's side. It seemed. But you know, things aren't always what they seem. And Jairus is just about to find out who's really in control of this situation. Hard on the heels of that first message, "Thy daughter is dead," there comes a second. "Be not afraid, only believe." Jairus was at what someone has called wit's end corner. But he was in good company, for he had the Lord with him. Are you standing at wit's end corner, Christian with troubled brow? You're thinking of what is before you and all you are bearing now? Does all the world seem against you and you in the battle alone? Remember, at wit's end corner is just where God's power is shown. You standing at wit's end corner, then you're just in the very spot to learn the wondrous resources of him who faileth not. No doubt to a brighter pathway, your footsteps will soon be removed, but only at wit's end corner is the God who is able proved. There are times when my wife and I are out visiting for the church, we find people whose circumstances have brought them to a place where things are utterly beyond them. And so often we say, what do people do who haven't the Lord to turn to in a situation like this? If you're not a Christian, who do you turn to when life falls in around you? Psalm 61 says, "When my heart is overwhelmed, lead me to the rock that is higher than I." I wouldn't like to be going through life without the Lord. We're just so glad to have the Good Shepherd to watch over us, so glad to be one of his sheep. Life's hard enough with the Lord, but where do you turn if you haven't him to turn to? Now, all what we've said so far this morning is what you might say is on the surface of this account. But C.H. Spurgeon, in one of his books, says, when you stand behind the Bible to preach it, never state the obvious. People can read that for themselves. So let's go underneath the surface a little bit and see if there's something more for each of us here this morning. First thing I'd like to draw your attention to is that we meet this man, Jairus, in a dual capacity in this passage. We're introduced to him firstly in his public life as a ruler of the synagogue, and then in his private life as a father and a husband. In his public life as a ruler of the synagogue, and there were a plurality of rulers, he was an administrator, one who was charged with the supervision of all matters pertaining to the synagogue. These were laymen whose duty it was to oversee the worship services and the upkeep of the building. He was, if you like, an elder and a deacon rolled into one. He and his fellow rulers chose the men to read the scriptures, to offer prayer, and to preach or explain the scripture at the weekly gatherings. It's probable that when the Lord went into the synagogue in Nazareth, which we read of in Luke 4, that it was one of the rulers who handed him the scroll of Isaiah from which he read and spoke. Now, as a ruler of the synagogue, Jairus would have been a well-known figure in the community. He was a public figure in Capernaum, and he would have been held in respect. Everybody knew him. But we see him here also in his private life as a father and a husband. And it's really in that capacity that we meet him in this passage. Jairus would have known that many of his fellow religionists had no love for the Lord. He would have known that if he stepped out of line, there might well be consequences, in inverted commas, relating to his position in the synagogue. But he was prepared, if need be, to run that risk. From the little we know of him here, he was what a father should be. God had entrusted his wife and he with a little girl, and he was going to do his best for her, whatever it cost him. Most of us gathered here this morning have these two aspects to our lives. There's the public and the private. And success or otherwise in our Christian life will depend in no small measure on striking the right balance between the two. Too much of an emphasis on one at the expense of the other will mean a deviation from the path that God has for us. There have been those in Christian work who have put too much emphasis on their public ministry, and it has cost them their family. I well remember the first time we went on a holiday to the Mediterranean. We went to the island of Corfu, and we met there another couple, just been married. She was a daughter of the manse. And at one time, a situation had arisen in the family, and her father, for the sake of his public responsibilities, took a particular course of action. She and her brother did believe that he didn't act correctly towards them at that time, and it had driven a wedge between him and them. We all need to be careful. There have been others who have placed too much emphasis on the family life at the expense of the Lord's work. We need to ask God for wisdom where to draw the line, for the Lord said in Matthew 10, "He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." We have responsibilities in both areas, and we need to balance the one carefully against the other. Now, let's be honest. Some people use one as an excuse for not doing the other. We have some who don't come out to midweek meetings because they say they need to spend quality time with their families. But the truth is, we all find time for the things that we want to do. The problem very often is not so much a conflict between church and family as a conflict between them and the things we bring into our lives and the time we need to spend on that. Some of you, no doubt, like a round of golf. I, as I've indicated, like to go fishing. And we can convince ourselves that we really need these things, and we're very good at quoting that verse which says, "Come ye yourselves apart and rest a while." But in all these things, brethren and sisters, does it not so often come down to a question of how we define our priorities and our personal preferences? If you were called home today and the Lord asked you to give an account of your stewardship of the time that he gave you on this earth, what would you say? remembering that you have to be totally honest? Would you have to confess that very often your own preferences took precedence? There's a difficulty in our church today to get men particularly to accept office. And I think much of it boils down to the fact that it would use up time they want to spend on themselves and on other things. I don't know what the situation is in your church, but I know what I've seen elsewhere, and I know the authors have said to me, do we not all at times need to sit down and take a long, hard look at our lives and at the things we do in the light of the fact that we all have an appointment at the judgment seat of Christ? Brethren and sisters, there are consequences to the things we do in life or maybe don't do, as the case may be. Your public life, your private life, your home life all have responsibilities, and we need to get them sorted. A good number of years ago, before there was electricity in the homes, Mother noticed one evening that her little girl was working very industriously by the light of her candle, and she asked her why. The little girl said, I have only one candle, and it will soon be done, and I haven't another. Life is like a candle, and it's quickly burning out, and we haven't long to do these things. For the love of Christ constraineth us, because we thus judge that if one died for all, then were all dead, that they which live should not henceforth live unto themselves, but unto him who died for them and rose again. We often sing Isaac Watts' well-known hymn, When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. There's a verse which is not in the hymn book, and it goes like this. His dying crimson like a robe spreads o'er his body on the tree. Then am I dead to all the globe, and all the globe is dead to me. Christ first, others next, self last. That's the order. But let's press on quickly, because in verse 23, there's something else I want to draw your attention to. Jairus, when he met the Lord, said, My little daughter lieth at the point of death. You know, that's a point to which every life in the natural course of events must come. The point of death. Many and diverse are the paths through life, but sooner or later, all will come here. Psalm 90 was written by Moses, the man of the wilderness, as he looked at life and death in his generation. He wrote, the days of our years are 70 years. And if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet is their strength labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. He didn't say, number our years. He said, number our days. Did you ever think that a day is a divine division of time? God so arranged this world that we have day and night. And every day paints a picture of a life. Morning paints our childhood. Noon, our manhood or our womanhood. And evening or night, our death. We don't attempt to reckon our mortal life by centuries, scarcely by years, for they are so uncertain and at best so few. Time is short and time is precious. Gold dust and diamonds are weighed by grains, not by tons. So because of its preciousness, time is dealt out in seconds. And we should number it not so much in decades nor in years, but in days. And yet, brethren and sisters, is there not a tendency with each of us to neglect to form a true estimate of our own life? Someone has said that all men think all men mortal, except themselves. It's been said that a right use of mortality is a priceless blessing. Men allow their days to slip away unnoticed. They count their oxen and their sheep, but not their days. They number other men's days, but not their own. Sir Thomas Smith, who I believe was secretary to Queen Elizabeth I, said shortly before his death, "It's a great pity that men do not know to what end they are born into this world until they're ready to go out of it." So teach us to number our days, to rightly assess the brevity and uncertainty of life, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. Surely it cannot be wisdom to live our lives for the things that will slip through our fingers when we come to this point of death. But Christian, here is wisdom. Always remember that you're a child of two worlds. You're in this world, but you're not of it. Your citizenship is in heaven. You're a stranger and a pilgrim on the earth. David used a word which is very graphic in the Old Testament to describe this aspect of things. He said in Psalm 39, "Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear unto my cry. Hold not thy peace at my tears, for I am a stranger with thee and a sojourner," and that's your word, "as all my fathers were." That word comes from a root which means to sit down. And it was always used to describe a foreign dweller in a country as distinguished from a native citizen. One who sat down with them for a while. Strangers, pilgrims and sojourners. Brethren, if that's what we are, let us live accordingly. But there's one other thing I would like to draw your attention to, and I'm hastening on. In verse 35, Jairus got that awful message, "Thy daughter is dead." It's over. Too late. It's finished. Not so. Too often, we would put a full stop where God only puts a comma. Brethren and sisters, if you forget everything I say this morning, will you remember that? Too often in life, we put a full stop where God only puts a comma. Too often when we come to the end of our resources, we think and act like God has come to the end of his. And we forget, do we not, that he is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or even think. To me, that's the main message of this passage. Jairus thought it was over, but everything was under the Lord's control. He thought it was a full stop, but it was only a comma. And you know, that's not the only place in the Bible that we get this message. You remember Paul in the storm as he was heading towards Rome. It says all hope that we should be saved was then taken away. It must be an awful moment when the last shred of hope is gone. And you look into the blackness and emptiness of a starless sky. Paul had that literally during those days of the storm. It says neither sun nor moon appeared in many days. No light, nothing to guide them by. Nothing to give them direction. And hope ebbed away. It seemed God had forgotten them. Not so, for God drew near in the darkness. And many a Christian could testify to the fact that it was in their darkest hour that God drew near. And the next morning, Paul had a different message. He said, "There stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve, and said, 'Fear not, Paul, for thou must be brought before Caesar. And lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee.'" Paul had put a full stop. God had put a comma. You remember Peter in the high priest's house that night the Lord was betrayed. You remember how he denied his Lord with oaths and curses. When humanly speaking, the Lord needed him most, he failed. And when the rooster told him about it, he went out and wept bitterly. He must have thought his service for the Lord was over. How could he have done such a thing? But he did. And yet, a few days later, on the shore of Galilee, what he had thought was a full stop turned out to be only a comma when the Lord said, "Feed my sheep." You remember John Mark, who went not with them to the work? Then there was the dissension which resulted from it. Paul said, "He's finished. He's a quitter. He hasn't got stickability. He won't do." And he put a big round full stop after John Mark's name. But you know, later in life, he had the grace to admit he was wrong. He said, "Bring Mark with you, for he is profitable unto me for the ministry." Think of the Lord on the cross. Their hopes were destroyed, their plans in ruins. What could look more like a full stop than a lifeless corpse hanging on a cross? But as someone, I think it was Max Lucado, has said, "It's Friday, but Sunday is coming." It wasn't a full stop. It was only a comma, and a glorious one at that. Brethren and sisters, I'm almost finished, but if Christianity means anything to us, surely it means what we have in Matthew chapter 1. "And they shall call his name Emmanuel," which being interpreted is God with us. The eternal God with all his omnipotence in the lives of ordinary women like you and me. And as we sometimes sing when we have come to the end of our hoarded resources, "Our Father's full giving has only begun. His love has no limit, his grace has no measure, his power no boundary known unto men. For out of his infinite riches in Jesus, he giveth and giveth and giveth again." When we can't see a way forward, God has a thousand things he can do. Don't underestimate God. Think in commas, not in full stops. God is omnipotent. Found a little poem the other day, and I'm going to close with this. "They cannot shell his temple, nor dynamite his throne. They cannot bomb his city, nor rob him of his own. They cannot take him captive, nor strike him dumb or blind, nor starve him to surrender, nor make him change his mind. They cannot cause him panic, nor cut off his supplies. They cannot take his kingdom nor hurt him with their lies. Though all the world be shattered, his truth remains the same, his righteous law still potent, and fathers still his name. Though we face war and struggle and feel their golden rod, we know above confusion they're always shattered.